Osho, The Secret of Secrets, Volume 1, Talks on the Secret of the Golden Flower, Discourse Number 5, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
Bhagwan, in the body is the anima. The anima is feminine, yin. It is the substance of consciousness. But besides this, there is the animus in which the spirit shelters. The animus lives in the eyes. It sees, it dreams. But whoever is in a dark and withdrawn mood and chained to his bodily form is fettered with the anima. Therefore, the concentration of the animus is brought about by the circulation of the light, and in this way the spirit is maintained, the anima subjugated. The method used by the ancients for escaping from the world consisted in melting out completely the slag of darkness in order to return to the purely creative. This is nothing more than a reduction of the anima and a completion of the animus. And the circulation of the light is the magical means of reducing the dark and gaining mastery over the anima. If this method is followed, plenty of seed water will be present of itself, the spirit fire will be ignited, and the thought earth will solidify and crystallize, and thus the holy fruit matures. The one nature, when it descends into the house of the creative, divides into animus and anima. The animus is the heavenly heart. It is of the nature of light. It is of the power of lightness and purity. It is that which we have received from the great emptiness, that which is identical in form with the primordial beginning. The anima partakes of the nature of the dark. It is the energy of the heavy and the turbid. It is bound to the bodily, fleshly heart. The animus loves life, the animus seeks death. All sensuous desires and impulses of anger are effects of the anima. But the pupil understands how to distill the dark anima completely, so that it transforms itself into pure light.
Once the Empress Wu asked the master Fa San if he could possibly give her a practical and simple demonstration of the principle of cosmic interrelatedness, of the relationship of the one and the many, of God and his creatures, and of the creatures one to another, Fa San went to work and appointed one of the palace rooms so that 8 large mirrors stood at the 8 points of the compass. Then he placed 2 more mirrors, one on the ceiling and one on the floor. A candle was suspended from the ceiling in the center of the room. When the Empress entered, Fa San lit the candle. The Empress cried, "How marvelous! How beautiful!" Fa San pointed at the reflection of the flame in each one of the 10 mirrors and said, "See, Your Majesty, this demonstrates the relationship of the one and the many, of God to each one of His creatures." The Empress said, "Yes, indeed, Master. And what is the relationship of each creature to the others?" Fa San answered, "Just watch, Your Majesty, how each mirror not only reflects the one flame in the center, each mirror also reflects the reflections of the flame in all the other mirrors, until an infinite number of flames fills them all. All these reflections are mutually identical. In a sense, they are interchangeable. In another sense, each one exists individually. This shows the true relationship of each being to its neighbor, to all that is. Of course, I must point out, Your Majesty, Fa Sang went on, that this is only a rough approximate and static parable of the real state of affairs in the universe. For the universe is limitless, and in it all is in perpetual, multidimensional motion. Then the Master covered one of the infinite number of reflections of the flame and showed how each apparently insignificant interference affects the whole organism of our world. Kegan expresses this relationship by the formula, one in all, all in one in one, all in all. Then Fa Sang, in order to conclude his command performance, held up a small crystal ball and said, "Now watch, Your Majesty, how all these large mirrors and all the myriad forms they reflect are mirrored in this little sphere. See how in the ultimate reality the infinitely small contains the infinitely large, and the infinitely large the infinitely small, without obstruction. Ah, if only I could demonstrate to you the unimpeded mutual interpenetration of time and eternity, of past, present and future. But alas, this is a dynamic process that must be grasped on a different level." Man is not an island. Nothing is. All is interrelated. All is interdependent. Independence, the very word, is false. So is dependence. The reality is interdependence. Everything is so deeply connected with everything else that nothing can exist apart. If you can understand a small rose flower in its totality, root and all, you would have understood the whole cosmos. Because the whole cosmos is involved in that small rose flower. In the smallest leaf of grass, all is contained. But remember, as Fa Sang said to the Empress, all illustrations, all descriptions are static. An existence is a dynamic flux. It is a river. Each thing goes on moving into each other thing. It is impossible to draw lines where one thing ends and another begins. There are no demarcating lines. There cannot be. So all distinctions are only for practical purposes. They have no existential value. This is the first thing to be understood. This is very fundamental to the Taoist alchemy. Once this is understood, then the whole alchemy of Taoism becomes comprehensible. then the lower can be transformed into the higher, because the lower contains the higher already. The baser metal can be transformed into gold, because nothing is separate. The baser contains the gold already. As above, so below. As below, so above. The very idea that all is interconnected makes transformation possible. If things are not interconnected, then there is no possibility of any transformation. If the world consists of philosopher Leibniz monads, windowless, separate atomic individuals, not connecting with each other at all, because they are windowless, then there is no possibility of any transformation. Transformation is conceivable only because you are me, I am you. We interpenetrate. Can you think yourself as separate even for a single moment? You cannot even imagine yourself as separate. The flower cannot be separated from the tree. The moment it is separated, it dies. The tree cannot be separated from the earth. The earth cannot be separated from the sun. The sun cannot be separated from other stars. And so on and so forth. You separate the leaf and the leaf dies. You separate the flower dies. You separate the tree from the tree dies. You separate the earth from the sun and the earth dies. Death means separation. Life means no separation. Hence the ego is bound to die, because that is your idea of separation. To think oneself in terms of ego is the only cause of death, because the ego is already dead. You can go on flogging the dead horse, but how long? It is going to die. It is already dead, that's why it is going to die. That which is alive in you cannot die. Life is eternal. But life is not yours. You cannot possess it. Life belongs to all. Life has a vastness, infinity. Death is tiny. Death is individual. Life is universal. So when you live, you are part of the universe. And when you die only because you thought you are separate. The more you feel part of the whole, the more life you will have. Jesus says, come to me and I will give you life abundant. What is the secret of life abundant? The secret is, die as the ego. Disappear as a separate entity. And the whole universe and all that it contains is yours. Stop possessing. and all is yours. Purges, and you are tiny and limited, and you are going to die. The secret of becoming more alive consists of a single phenomenon of dropping the idea of separation. And whenever it happens, you feel a life becoming aflame in you. Even in small measures, if it happens, if you fall in love with somebody, life is aflame in you. And it is not that much has happened. Just two persons are feeling one. Learn the lesson from love. Just two persons feeling one. And what joy. And what ecstasy. Think, if you fall in love with the whole, then how much ecstasy and how much joy is going to happen. That is life abundant, life infinite. Separate yourself. There are few people who live so egoistically that they cannot love. They are the most miserable people in the world. My definition of hell is to live in separation is hell. To live in non-separation is heaven. To disappear completely, utterly into the whole is moksha, nirvana. It is ultimate freedom. The second thing to be understood, that life is polar. That is also very fundamental to Taoist approach. But the polarity is not that of opposition. The polarity means that the opposites are complementary to each other. They support. A life cannot exist without death. Hence, death is not the enemy. How death can be the enemy of life if life cannot exist without it? It has to be the friend. It prepares ground for life. It helps life. It provokes life. It challenges life. Just think that if your body was going to live for eternity, you will not live at all, because you will have infinity to postpone everything. Why love today if there is tomorrow? And if the tomorrow is infinite, then why bother? Why dance today? We will see tomorrow. Just imagine if your bodily life was going to be eternal. Your postponement will become eternal. You cannot postpone because you are not certain whether there is going to be any tomorrow or not. Nobody knows whether the next breath will come in or not. Hence only foolish people postpone. The wise lives, and the wise lives here now. He cannot afford postponement, because he knows only this moment is mine. This very moment is only mine. The next moment maybe, may not be. How can I postpone? How can I say tomorrow? The foolish postpones for tomorrow. The wise lives now. The wise knows no other time than now, and no other space than here. And the foolish goes on things which could have been postponed for eternity. He lives them right now. If he is angry, he lives it right now. If he is loving, he says, we will see tomorrow. All that is stupid. He goes on living. And all that is luminous, he goes on postponing. The wise also postpones, but he only postpones stupid things. Gurdjieff used to say to his disciples that when my grandfather died, I was only 9 years old. He called me close to his deathbed, whispered in my ear. He had tremendous love for this small boy. He must have seen the potential of the boy. He whispered in the ears of the boy that I have nothing to give to you except a simple advice, and I don't know whether you will be able to understand it right now or not. But remember it. Someday you may become capable enough, mature enough to understand it. Just remember it. And it is a simple advice. If you want to do anything wrong, postpone it for 24 hours. And if you do want to do something right, never postpone even for a single moment. If you want to be angry, violent, aggressive, postpone for 24 hours. If you want to be loving, saving, not even for a single moment postpone. Just live it right now, immediately. And Gurdjieff used to say to his disciples, that simple advice transformed my whole life. How can you be angry if you can postpone for 24 hours? It is impossible. To be so calm and quiet, to postpone it for 24 hours, is enough guarantee that you are not going to be angry. And who can be angry if he can postpone for 24 hours? 24 hours of contemplation, and the whole absurdity will be plain to you. And the whole thing will look ridiculous. And Gurdjieff was really transformed by a simple message. Sometimes very simple messages can transform you, but you have to live them. Life exists because there is death. Death gives intensity to life. Death challenges life. It provokes you to live. And to live at the maximum, at the optimum, because who knows, there may be no tomorrow. Death is always provoking you, goading you to live, and to live totally. Then death is not against life, but a friend. So is the case with all the polarities, the negative and the positive. Love and hate, beauty and ugliness, day and night, summer and winter. And so is the case with man and woman. Man cannot be without the woman. and the woman cannot be without the man. They are part of one dialectical process. Between these two polars, there is attraction and repulsion both. Because attraction and repulsion cannot be separated. Hence you feel attracted towards the woman or towards the man, and repulse at the same time. A part of you wants to be with the woman, a part of you wants to be alone. You are always hesitating. If you are with the woman or with the man, you start longing for freedom. To be on one's own, to be alone. Suddenly, you become very much interested in being alone and free. And you don't know from where this desire to be free is coming. The woman are the men, the others, is provoking it. The moment you have left the other, this desire, this longing, this great longing to be alone will disappear. And then you are surprised, really surprised. When you are alone, you simply feel lonely. You don't feel that joy that you had contemplated. You don't see any freedom. You simply see loneliness surrounding you. And your whole existence becomes cold, frozen, dark. Again the desire arises to be with the others. Now you hanker for love, for togetherness. This is the problem between man and woman. They are attracted and repulsed together, simultaneously. They want to come to be together and they want to be separate and alone on their own. Hence the constant conflict between man and woman. Marriage is a love-hate affair. Attraction-repulsion affair. If the marriage lasts long, it can last only if there are many divorces happening every day. Only then it can last long. If the man and the woman have decided not to fight, then it is a plastic marriage. They will be together. They will manage to be together. But they will never be together in reality. They will never know those moments of unity. They are only pretending. They are being polite, but not true, not authentic. Marriage is a kind of intimate enmity. It is intimate enmity. It is a friendly fight. It is a war. Yes, between two wars there are peaceful moments too. And they are beautiful because of the two wars. Couples go on fighting. That's how they keep alive the flame of love. Once they fight, they go away from each other. When they are far away from each other in their psychologies, they start hankering for the other. They start missing the other. Then they start seeking and groping for the other. Then they come close. And very close. because they have tasted something of loneliness. Now they want to be very close. Once they have tasted of closeness, they want to be separate again. So don't be worried about it. It is a fundamental phenomenon. You cannot escape it. The only way to escape is to have a pretend marriage, which is not a true marriage. Remain polite to each other. It is a kind of contract that I need you and you need me, that I will scratch your back and you scratch my back. That's all. Because I need you and you need me. You are my security, I will be your security. It is a legal contract, but not marriage. This is the second fundamental to be understood before you can enter into the sutras. And the third and the most important thing. The third fundamental is that no man is only man and no woman is only woman. Man is both, woman is both. Both are both. Man contains a woman within him, and so is the case with a woman. The woman contains a man within her. So it is not only a question of the outside man or outside woman. It is also an inner phenomenon, because the outer and the inner correspond. Just as I said, as below, so above, I can say, as outer, so inner. Your inner reality also is the same as your outer reality. They correspond. They balance. Now more complexity arises, because each man has a woman within him, and he has to come to terms with her. It is not only a question that you have a woman outside that you love. Otherwise things will have been less complicated. Whenever two persons are in love, really there are four persons. In each bed there are four persons. Complexity you can understand. Whenever two persons make love, there are four persons making love. It is always group sex. Because the man has a woman inside him, and the woman has a man inside her. And it is bound to be so. Because each is born out of the marriage of a man and a woman. Something of the father will be in you, 50%. Something of the mother will be in you, 50%. To each, the father contributes and the mother contributes. You may be biologically a man. That simply shows that physically you have a mechanism of the man, but deep in your psyche you are neither man nor woman, you are both. That's why I say, if we have to use one word for both man and woman, up to now we have been using man. That means it contains both. It is only because man has been very dominant in the past, but in the future the pendulum may swing to the other pole and will be far truer, Because the word man does not contain woman, but the word woman contains man. It will be better to use as a general word woman for both. And so is the case with he and she. She contains he, but he does not contain. It will be better to use she for both, woman for both. It will be better to use she for God than he. But both contain each other. Because of this, there is a possibility of homosexuality. Because of this fundamental duality inside, you may be a man on the outside, and you may become attuned to your inner woman inside. There is no problem in it. Your spirit remains free. Inside it can either become identified with the inner man, or it can become with the inner woman. If you are man physically and you become identified with the woman inside, homosexuality will be the consequence. It can happen in many ways. It can happen for many reasons. So homosexuality is possible because of this inner duality. And now science is capable even to change your physical sex. That too is possible because Taoist finding has been found to be scientifically true too. Now just by changing hormones and your chemistry a little bit, the man can become a woman and the woman can become a man, even physiologically too. That simply shows that you are both. The difference even in the body is only of emphasis. And sometimes it happens on its own accord too. It has been found a woman becomes a man, or a man becomes a woman. The difference must not have been much, may have been very, very slight. 51% man, 49% woman. Just a little balance is on the side of being a man. It can change in the course of life. New hormones, new food, new climate, new atmosphere, new emotions, illnesses, or anything can change the balance. And the man can become a woman, or the woman can become a man. And now science knows that it can be done very easily. There is every possibility that in future people will change it more often. Because if you can live both the polarities in one life, then why not? If you can enjoy both the visions, then why not? You will have more freedom. You have lived as a man for 35 years, and enough is enough. And you would like to see how it is from the other side. Because there is no other way to know how it is from the other side than to be on that side. My own observation of thousands of people
has been this, that if a person is man in this life, in the next life he is born as a woman, and vice versa. And the reason is simple, he becomes tired of being a man, or becomes tired of being a woman, and he starts deep down hankering for the other polarity. And naturally in the next life, because of this great desire to be the other, he is born as the other. These are the three fundamentals. First, everything is interdependent. Second, life is polar, and the polarities are not opposites but complementaries. And third, that each is double inside. No one is single. In India we have the concept of Ardhanarishwar that corresponds to Taoist approach. Shiva has been sculptured, painted as both half man, half woman. Half of his body is of man and half of his body is that of a woman. When for the first time those statues were discovered by the West laughed. It looks so absurd. What is the point of it? Now, they have understood what is the point of it. It is one of the most fundamental things of life. So are you, just as Shiva, half-half. These sutras are concerned with this inner polarity. And unless you transcend this inner polarity, you will not attain to the one, you will remain two. Meditation is a way to transcend this polarity within you. Meditation takes you away from all dualisms. In ordinary life, you remain dual. And in the 24 hours time, you change many times from one polarity to another. You watch. You may be a man, but sometimes you are very feminine, very vulnerable. You may be a woman, but sometimes in the daytime you are very masculine. When the woman is masculine, she becomes very, very aggressive. More aggressive than any man can ever be. Because her aggressiveness is very fresh, unused. Just like unused land is very much fertile. And so is the case with men. If a man is tender, he is very much tender, more than the woman. Because that is unused soil. That part of his being has not been used. It is fresh, very alive. So this strange phenomena is observed again and again if you become a little watchful. Woman is generally loving. Man is not generally loving. Woman is only sometimes quarrelsome. But when she is, then she really is. Man is only sometimes loving, but when he is, he really is. Those are the unused parts of their being. When they are used, they have a freshness. This inner polarity keeps you in a kind of anguish, conflict. Without it, you cannot exist. The one remains invisible. That's why God is invisible. To become visible, the one has to become two. You have to write with a white chalk on a blackboard. Only then those words can be seen. To exist, one needs contrast. That's why in the daytime you cannot see stars. In the night time you can see. The darkness of the night becomes the background. The stars are there as much as in the night. They don't go anywhere. They can't go anywhere. They are where they are. They don't start coming in the night. They don't start hiding somewhere in the day. They are where they are. But in the day, the contrast is missing. You cannot see them. They are invisible. God is invisible. If he wants to become visible, he will have to become man and woman. He will have to become two. He will have to become matter and spirit. He will have to become body and soul. He will have to become this and that. Only the two is visible. The world consists of the two. The world is dual. And the moment you can manage to make this duality disappear in oneness, you will become invisible. That is the meaning of the Taoist saying, which seems very mysterious, that the man of Tao becomes invisible. It has great significance, but it is a metaphor. It does not mean that you cannot see Laos. Or you cannot see me, you are seeing already. But still you are not seeing me. That part has become invisible. The polarity has disappeared inside. The duality is no more there. Only the dual can be seen. The non-dual becomes unseen. God has to become two. Only then the game, the play, is possible. Ancient Indian scriptures say, he felt very lonely. He means God. He felt very lonely. He longed for the other. That's why he became two. He became man and woman, cow and bull, and so on and so forth. The whole existence is sexual. By sexual I mean dual. The whole existence is sexual. Sooner or later, science is going to discover that there are planets which are male, and there are planets which are female. It has to be so. Ancient astrology says so. and I perfectly agree with it. Everything is dual. That's why sun is represented as male and moon as female. It is not poetry. It is fact. Science may not have yet discovered it, but it has to be so. If everything is dual, then there cannot be any exceptions. Your attraction for the woman or for the man keeps you in manifestation. Now you will be able to understand why the great mystics down the ages have been teaching you how to go beyond sex. Because unless you go beyond sex, you will not go in God. Unless you go beyond sex, you will never go beyond the two. You will remain tethered to the duality of the world. The world means God manifest, and God means the world disappearing into unmanifestation again. That too is a duality, manifestation, non-manifestation. In the Christian theology, things are not so deep. They are very superficial. In Christian theology, you have only creation. What about decreation? How can be creation without decreation? In the Eastern theology, they are both together. Srishti means creation, pralaya means decreation. There is a moment when God becomes manifest, and then there is a moment when God becomes unmanifest again. All disappears into nothingness. Zero follows. Just like you, I told you in the beginning, you are with your beloved, you become tired. You want to meditate. You want to go to the Himalayas. God also becomes tired from the world. Naturally so. Then he wants to go into retirement. Then he disappears into oneness. Dissolution follows. All disappears. But again, how long you can sit in a Himalayan cave? Even God becomes tired of it. He starts seeking and searching and creating the other again. And exactly so happens in each individual soul. You live the life, then you become tired. Then you want to go beyond life. You have lived your body and you are tired. Now you want to go beyond body. And then you can understand my insistence. Why I say, don't be afraid of the world and don't escape from the world. Because world is the very place where renunciation happens. It is a polarity. That's why I don't say escape from the woman or the man. If you escape, you may remain interested. Don't escape. Live it through and through. Indulge in the world. And the very indulgence will become renunciation. Out of that very indulgence, you will start feeling now it is time to disappear into absolute aloneness. And if you are really tired, only then you can go into that absolute aloneness. People are bound to misunderstand me. In India, I am one of the most misunderstood man. They think I am teaching people indulgence. I am teaching renunciation. They think I am teaching a worldly kind of sannyas. They don't understand. I am teaching real sannyas. Because real sannyas arises only out of the worldly experience. Real sannyas is not possible in a cave in the Himalayas. It will be unreal, imposed. And deep down you will remain worldly. And you will continue to hanker and dream of the world. Live in the world. Really live in so you get tired, wearied, finished with it. So much so that one day suddenly it loses all meaning for you. And the renunciation has happened. To me, the real renunciation happens in the marketplace and only in the marketplace. Now the sutras. In the body is the anima. The anima is feminine, in. It is the substance of consciousness. In each being, there is anima. Anima means the feminine principle, the passive principle, the inactive principle, the woman. In. It is the substance of consciousness. It is not consciousness itself, but the substance. Without it, consciousness cannot exist. It is the very matter. It is the house in which consciousness lives. Without it, the consciousness cannot live. The woman, and remember by woman, I don't mean just woman. I mean the woman principle. And that you have to remember continuously. Otherwise you will start feeling that these Taoist people seem to be against women. They are not. They are not saying anything against our fire. They are simply describing. And they are not saying anything for man or for woman. They are talking about the principles of womanhood and manhood. In the body is the anima. The anima is feminine. It is the substance of consciousness. That's why. Because of the feminine principle, women remain too much attached to their bodies. Man is not so attached to his body. Really is careless about the body. If there is no woman around, the man becomes dirty. Dusty. The room becomes unclean. As if he is not aware of all this. You can see whenever you enter a room whether the man lives alone or is there a woman in the house. It is so simple. You can see whether the man is a bachelor or not, just by seeing his room. The books have collected dust for months. He He is not careful about the body, the material part of himself. But the woman is very careful, immensely careful. Hence, she stands so long before the mirror. One day Mullah Nasruddin was catching flies. And he caught few. And he told to his wife, "I have found 2 female flies and 2 male flies." The woman said, "This is surprising. How could you find the sex of the flies?" He said, "2 were sitting on the mirror and 2 were reading newspapers." It is very simple. The woman is immensely tethered to the body, to the substance, to the house. If man was left alone, at the most there would have been tents, but not houses. It is a woman who has created the whole civilization. Because without the houses, there will be no civilization, remember. Without the houses, there will be no cities. And civilization grows in cities. The very word civilization comes from citizens, the people who live in the cities. The woman has created the whole civilization. Man would have remained a vagabond, a wanderer, a traveler, a hunter. He would have rushed from one place to another. You can see it in many ways. There are many manifestations of it. The West is more male-oriented. Hence you see so many Western tourists moving around the world. You don't see so many Eastern tourists. The East is very much feminine. The woman remains attached to the property, the house, the car, the land, her ornaments, her clothes. This is because of the principle inside. She is the substance of consciousness. And remember, without a woman, the spirit cannot soar high. Great poetry is born through men, but the cause is always the woman. You don't come across great women poets. I have looked into the poetry women write. They try hard. But nothing much happens. Madhuri writes great poetry. But it is not really poetry. A woman cannot write poetry, she can inspire poetry, that is true. No great poetry arrives in the world without a woman somewhere in the background. She inspires. Her presence, her love, her caring creates it. She need not write it, the man will write it. But she is the inspiration, the cause. a very subtle cause. No women are great painters. Not that they don't paint, particularly in the modern age, they do everything that man has always been doing. There is a great competition. They think they have to do all the things that man has been doing. They think because of these things, man has become important. The logic is fallacious. They will become only imitative men. They will lose their own soul. And they will always remain second hand. In the world of men, to compete with men, they will remain secondary. They will not be ever primary. That is not the way to compete. If you become like men, you will never be as competent as men. How you can be? His male principle is behind him. You will become ugly. You will become rough. You will lose all softness. That's why the LIV movement has been one of the most disastrous thing that has happened to women. And the reason is not that their ideology is wrong. Its implementation is wrong. Woman is equal to man, but she is not the same as man, and she should not be. She should follow her own nature. She should listen to her own soul. She has a different wife. She has a different function to fulfill in the world, a different destiny. If she follows man and imitates, she is lost. And the more she will be lost, the more she will become uprooted from her being, the more she will become false, plastic, synthetic, the more desperate she will be. That's why the LIV women are very much angry, constantly in rage. The rage is that they are feeling frustrated. They are not being as they wanted to. They cannot be. It is against nature. There is no need either. In the body is the anima is feminine, the in principle. It is the substance of consciousness. Meditate over the word, substance of consciousness. The very foundation of consciousness. But it is not consciousness itself, the house where consciousness lives. But besides this, there is the animus in which the spirit shelters. Animus is the male principle. Young. The animus lives in the eyes. It sees, it dreams. The feminine principle lives in the body. It is very material. That's why women are always materialistic. Their considerations are very practical. They are very pragmatic. Mullah Nasruddin was saying to me one day that he never quarrels with his wife. I asked him, how do you manage it? It is almost impossible, or next to impossible. He said, we have managed it perfectly well for many years. The first night we decided a single principle and we have followed it. And the principle is, she decides about small things and I decide about big things. I asked, what do you mean by small things and big things? He said, for example, what car to purchase, what house to live in, to what school the children have to be sent, what food has to be eaten, what clothes have to be purchased. These all small things she decides. And I said, what you decide? He said, whether God exists or not, whether there is a hell or heaven or not, all great problems, that is for me. And the principle has worked out perfectly well. She never interferes in great things, I never interfere in small things. I am master of my own, she is master of her own world. We never overlap. The feminine principle is rooted in matter, rooted in body. But man dreams. Man is a dreamer. The male principle is the principle of dreaming. No woman can understand why people are so much interested in going to the moon. It looks so foolish. For what? What you are going to get there? Some shopping? Better to go to the MG Road than going to the moon. What you will be doing there? For what? And risking your life. No woman can understand why a man wants to reach to the Everest. What you are going to get there? It looks so ridiculous. And all women deep inside know that all men are childish. Let them play. Let them go and do their things. She knows perfectly well that they are interested in foolish things. Football match, cricket, all nonsense. Makes no sense. You throw the ball on that side and they throw the ball on your side and this goes on and on. What is the point in it? The woman is practical, down to earth. She is earthly. The male principle is like a sky and the female principle is like the earth. Man dreams, plans, desires, longs for unknown things. Man is an adventurer, ready to risk life for any dream that takes possession of him. The woman lives in the ears and the man lives in the eyes. Hence the desire in women of gossiping. Such immense joy in gossiping. Just look, two women gossiping. They look in such ecstasy. I have heard once there was a competition in China, a competition to decide who is the greatest liar in the country. And many people came and told many lies. And the man who won the prize was the man who said, I saw in a park two women sitting on one bench silently for half an hour. He won the first prize. It is impossible. Because of the woman, the fall, the original sin happened. The snake must have tried first on Adam, but Adam is not the ears. He is the eyes. He must have seen the tricky snake. And he must have said, keep to yourself. Don't bother me. I have my own dreams. But the snake persuaded Eve. He must have gossiped to her. This was a gossip. That what are you doing? And here is the tree of knowledge. And God has deceived you. If you eat the fruit of this tree, you will become as immortal as God. If you eat the fruit of this tree, you will know all that God knows. You will be omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent. The woman naturally became curious. Such a practical thing. The snake persuaded her. The snake is the first salesman. Salesmen don't go to men. When the man goes to the office, then they knock on the door. The woman has to be persuaded. Only the woman has ears. Ears are the passive part of your being, receptive part. Something can enter from the ears. The eyes are aggressive part. You cannot be aggressive from the ears, remember. But with the eyes you can be aggressive. You can look in such a way at a person as if your eyes are daggers. You can offend people by your eyes. Or you can love people by your eyes. You can reach people by your eyes. Or you can become unreachable. Somebody can look into your eyes so vacantly that he becomes unreachable. Somebody can look into you so absently that he is unreachable. Or somebody can look with such desire, such passion, such longing, such caring, that his eyes almost start caressing your body. The eyes are aggressive parts. They can project. They can reach. In India, the person who stares at women offensively is called Lucha. And you will be surprised. The word Lucha comes from Lochan. Lochan means eyes. From his eyes, he is raping. His eyes can become almost his genital organs. Eyes are dangerous. Ears are very innocent. They only take in. They are feminine. The animus lives in the eyes, it sees, it dreams. But whoever is in a dark and withdrawn mood and chained to his bodily form is fettered by the anima. But whenever you are in a withdrawn mood, in a mood of passivity. Then you are chained with the body and you are chained by the anima. It does not matter whether you are man or woman. If a woman is using her eyes and is trying to see rather than trying to listen, she becomes animus. If a man is trying to listen, he becomes anima. A disciple becomes anima, has to become, because a disciple is needed to become all ears and nothing else. The master is all eyes and the disciple is all ears. The master has to see and has to see deepest in you. He has to penetrate your very core. And the disciple has to listen, to be attentive, to be available, to be allowing the master to reach to the very innermost core of his being. The disciple becomes feminine. That's why women are the best disciples in the world. Man finds a little difficulty in becoming a disciple. Even if he becomes reluctantly. He resists, he fights, he doubts, he creates many, many ways somehow to escape. If he cannot, then helplessly he relaxes. But helplessly, the woman jumps joyously. The greatest disciples have been women. And the proportion has always remained the same. If there are 5 disciples, 1 will be men, 4 will be women. That has been the proportion. It was so with Mahavira, it was so with Buddha, it is so with me. It has always been so. Men thinks women are starry-eyed, hypnotically available, suggestible. These are men's condemnations. He thinks himself he cannot be hypnotized. Women are very, very ready to be hypnotized, he thinks. And in a way he is right. In a way he is wrong too. If the woman comes to the snake, she will be converted by the snake. If the woman comes to a Buddha, she will be converted by a Buddha. Yes, she is suggestible. It all depends to whom she comes. If a man listens to the snake, he will not be converted. He will be saved from the snake. But if he comes to listen to Buddha, he will not be converted there either. Now he has missed his salvation. Therefore, the concentration of the animus is brought about by the circulation of the light, and in this way the spirit is maintained, the anima subjugated. The light has to circulate in the eyes. The eyes are the most lighted part of your being. Taoists say, your eyes are parallel to the sun. If you don't have eyes, you cannot see light. And only the similar can see the similar. Your eyes are condensed light. That's why you can see light through the eyes. Your ears are condensed sounds. That's why you can hear from the ears. the anima in everybody, whether man or woman, has to be subjugated. Why? Because it is the form, it is the body, it is the matter. The spirit has to be the master. The spirit has to rise above the body. The spirit has to make the body follow it, not vice versa. So whether one is a man or a woman, it doesn't matter. The anima inside has to be made a follower of the animus. Because only the animus can search and seek. And if the woman is coming behind, the animus can go perfectly deep into reality. If the poet knows that the woman is behind him, supporting him, his poetry can soar very high. If the man knows that the woman is always with him, he has great strength. He can go on any adventure. The moment he feels the woman is not with him, his energy is cut. Now he has only dreams, but they are impotent. They have no more energy. They cannot be realized. The realizing factor is the woman. The dreaming factor is the man. In the search for God or truth, the man has to lead and the woman has to follow. Inside you, the animus has to become the master and the anima has to become the disciple. And remember again, irrespective of the fact whether you are man or woman, the method used by the ancients for escaping from the world consisted in melting out completely the slag of darkness in order to return to the purely creative. The woman is stagnant. The man is dynamic. That's why you see women look so restful and men look so restless. Even when you were a child, just a small child, a baby, the difference was there. The boy baby is very restless, is trying to grab this, to grab that, trying to reach somewhere, is a nuisance. And the girl baby is never a nuisance, sits silently, hugging her doll. She is also a doll. A tremendous restfulness. The principle of rest is woman, and the principle of restlessness is man. Hence the roundness and the beauty of women, and the constant feverish state of men. But to grow, you will need the restless principle in you. Because growth means change. The woman is basically orthodox. The man is basically non-conventional. The woman always supports the status quo, and the man is always ready to go for any stupid revolution. anything is changing and he is for it. Whether it is changing for good or bad, that is not such an important thing. Change is good. The woman is always for the old, the established. Whether it is good or bad is not the question, because it has been always so. So it has to be so. Growth needs that the principle of staticness in you has to be melted. The woman is frozen. It has to be melted so you can become a river. But the river also needs support of the banks, which are static. Remember, if the river has no banks, it will never reach to the ocean. And if the river is frozen, it will never reach to the ocean. So the river has to melt, become water, and it still has to take the support of the banks, which are static. The perfect man is one who has used his dynamism as the river and who has used his staticness as the banks. This is the perfect balance. Then you have used your animus to grow and you have used your anima to make your growth a established fact, not just a momentary phenomenon. This is nothing more than a reduction of the anima and completion of the animus. But ordinarily, man, women, everybody has become static. Even men are so orthodox, Christians, Hindus, Mohammedans, Jainas, even men are so orthodox. They have fallen victim to their anima. Their animus has been subjugated. It has to be released. That's my whole effort here, to release your animus from the grip of the anima. Once the animus is released from the grip of your anima, then we can use the anima too, but not before it. Hence my insistence on dynamic methods of meditation. Only once in a while I suggest people to go to Zazen, Vipassana. Only when I see that their animus is flowing, now they can use their anima. Vipassana, Zazen are anima methods, feminine methods. Sufi dancing, chaotic meditation, Nataraj, they are animus methods. First you have to become a river, then only your banks can be used as a support. And the circulation of the light is the magical means of reducing the dark and gaining mastery over the anima. If this method is followed, plenty of seed water will be present of itself, the spirit fire will be ignited, and the thought earth will solidify and crystallize, and thus the holy fruit matures. The holy fruit is neither male nor female. The holy fruit matures only in wholeness. When your anima and animus are supporting each other like two wings of a bird, then eros is released, logos is released, intuition is released. Then you start flying into the sky, and yet you remain rooted in the earth. A tree, to go high in the sky, will need deep roots into the earth. The earth is anima, the sky is animus. And the higher the tree goes into the sky, the deeper it has to go into the earth, in the same proportion. The one nature, when it descends into the house of the creative, divides into animus and anima. God is one, but when he becomes creative, he divides himself into two, animus and anima. Without it, there is no possibility of manifestation. Without it, there will be no dialectics. God divides himself into thesis and antithesis. Because only through thesis and antithesis, the challenge, the conflict, the struggle, and through the struggle, the friction, energy is created. It is just like you strike two stones and fire comes up. It is just like you strike two hands and sound is created. Zen masters say, find the sound of one hand clapping. What do they mean? They mean, go beyond the two so you can find the one. But that one is the unmanifest God. That one is the very source from where we have come. And we can reach to the source only when our two-ness has disappeared. Now this two-ness has to be used in such a way that the thesis and antithesis become synthesis. That is the whole art of life. And that's what I am teaching to you. My sannyasin has to be a synthesis of man and woman, of day and night, of world and renunciation, of matter and spirit, of earth and sky. The animus is in the heavenly heart, in the third eye. It is of the nature of light. It is the power of lightness and purity. It is that which we have received from the great emptiness, the great sky. That which is identical in form with the primordial beginning. The anima partakes of the nature of the dark. Hence the mystery of the woman. No man has ever been able to unravel the mystery. Unless one has gone beyond the both, unless one has become a Buddha, then he knows the mystery of man and woman both. Otherwise, no man has been ever able to plumb the depths of a woman. The woman remains mysterious, dark. A dark night. You cannot see clearly. You can grope at the most. You can never be logically clear about the woman. She never follows logic. Her path is very zigzag. She jumps on conclusions directly without ever going through the process. The man goes step by step through the process. He is methodological. The woman is a poet in the sense that she is intuitive. She may not create poetry. She is a poet without creating any poetry. Her life is her poetry, and it is as dark as poetry. Mysterious, vague, ambiguous. Nothing is clear. Nothing can ever be clear. The woman cannot be demystified. She remains always a question mark. Man is clear, like light. Hence man looks shallow. Woman looks deep. Hence man seems to be completely on the surface. You can know about him. If you know about him, you can be predictable about him. But you can never be predictable about a woman. She remains unpredictable. Hence the darkness. These are metaphors. It is the energy of the heavy and the turbid. And the woman, the principle of feminine, keeps you tethered to the earth. It is gravitation. It is bound to the bodily, fleshly heart. The animus loves life. The anima seeks death. The woman is more like death. Don't feel offended. This is just a description. If the word anima and animus, man and woman, create some trouble in you, you can replace them by X, Y. But that is what the book of the golden flower is doing. These are just metaphors to make them anthropomorphic, helps them to be understood more clearly. Man is interested in life. Woman is interested in security. Man is interested in love. Woman is interested in safety. Man is interested in adventure. Woman is interested in comfort, convenience. Woman is death. By death, there is no condemnation meant or supposed. Just the quality of death is security. You are secure only when you are dead. You are secure only when you are not. Then nothing can happen to you anymore. But man wants to seek and search, to risk. That's why the husband goes on looking for other women. And the woman goes on watching the husband. She cannot conceive why he is still interested in other women. I am here. But the male principle is always interested in something new, in sensational, new thrill. And sometimes it happens that his own wife may be a beauty, and he may start fooling around with an ugly woman. Nobody can see the point of it. What is happening? You have such a beautiful woman, and what are you doing? But you don't understand the male principle. The male principle is basically polygamous. And the feminine principle is monogamous. She wants to settle. She is more interested in marriage than in love. She is interested in love only to get married. And man gets married only because he is interested in love. There is an ancient saying that the world will be immensely joyful if every man remained unmarried and every woman was married. But how it can be done? It is very impossible. The animus loves life, the anima seeks death. All sensuous desires and impulses of anger are effects of the anima. But the pupil understands how to distill the dark anima completely so that it transforms into itself into pure light. But the alchemy consists in to understand these two principles in each of you, man or woman, and to transform the anima, the dark part in you, into the light part, to help the dark part to move, to help the dark part, to help the light part, and not to fight with it. If your anima can help your animus, that is real marriage, inner marriage. Then you start becoming integrated. Then your light is no more shallow, it has the depth of darkness. And your darkness is no more dark, it has the light of lightness. Then anima and animus melt into each other. And when they melt utterly, the world has disappeared. You are again one. And to be one is to know God. To remain two is to remain in the world. And the secret and the experiment has to happen within you. It has nothing to do with the outside world. Inside you, these two principles are constantly in fight. Call life, death, darkness, light, man, woman, X, Y, whatsoever you will. But these two principles are there, continuously in fight. And that is your anguish, your misery, your hell. Let them become friends. Let your energy circulate in them, not against each other. Let them come closer to each other. Let there be an inner orgasm, an inner intercourse between the woman and the man. That's what in Tantra is called Yoga Nadha. Meeting of the man and the woman within you. That is real Tantra. The meeting of the man and woman on the outside is just an introduction. Sudha leads the Tantra group. That is just an introduction. The real Tantra has yet to begin. She is just preparing you. The real Tantra group will soon start when I see that now you are ready to go in and meet there with your inner woman and inner man. When I see your outer interest is no more so strong to keep you out, is no more so binding on you, the chain is broken, then the real Tantra group will start. I am waiting for the new commune to happen, because the new Tantra group will need a totally different kind of climate, a totally different kind of atmosphere. This is the greatest experiment that a man can go through. And this experiment releases in you cosmic ecstasy, total orgasm. Enough for today.